We'll convene the meeting of the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee, and we do have a quorum here, or and a quorum has checked in. And at this time, I'm going to turn the meeting over to Senator Sharon, who would like to introduce her bill. We've had some information about the bill, but at this time, she would like to introduce her bill.
Senator Sharon. I'd like to introduce Senate File 13, and we've had a lot of testimony in the bill, but we haven't actually introduced the bill as of yet, so I'd like to introduce Senate File 13 and offer an author's amendment, which is a delete-all amendment to the bill.
I'm sorry, Senator Sharon, I wasn't paying attention.
I'd like to offer the delete-all amendment. Is it 13?
It's the A-10 amendment?
A-10 amendment.
Okay.
It's a delete-all amendment.
Senator Sharon, would you like to address the A-10 amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I'm trying to think about, we've really sort of talked about the bill, so what I'd like to talk about now, unless there are other questions that members of the committee would like to ask me, is the changes that have been made in this delete all amendment to accommodate and to address issues and concerns that have been expressed to us before the last meeting, during the last meeting, from members of the committee and people who have been meeting with me during the since we last gathered here. So what this delete all amendment does that's different from the first time that we met here is it makes a change. Under Section 2, Subdivision 1, you'll see that there is a 1% per year reduction requirement. That is, the language in that section makes a more flexible opportunity for that 1% per year reduction to be made flexible. So a determination can be made. Let's see if I can.
Different reduction schedule.
So upon request, what it is saying here, which is new under its under section 2, it's line 213, upon request of a responsible party, the commissioner shall, after notice and hearing, determine a different reduction schedule for a particular responsible party if the responsible party demonstrates that the public interest is served by a different schedule. So this was to create some flexibility for concerns about people that the 1% per year reduction schedule would be too onerous. Also, the new language addresses the oil refinery's concern under Section 2, Subdivision 2, that concern was about whether or not there would in fact be a regulatory requirement for E20 and whether or not that waiver would have been achieved. And this language creates an off-ramp that allows for the failure to get a federal E20 waiver. Under Section 2, Subdivision 2, there's another off-ramp for fuel price increases, which is to address any concerns, particularly those expressed by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the oil refineries' concerns about the price of fuel increasing exponentially in a way that it would make an onerous impact on business and industry and on the value of the product. Another concern expressed, a sincere concern expressed by the oil refinery, is addressed in Section 2, Subdivision 2 as well. It's an off-ramp in the event that technologies and resources are not available to meet the standard. This relates to those concerns that were expressed that suggested that if they didn't have the capacity or the technology or the new fuels were not available in order to meet the second half of the after the E20 waiver, that there would be a possibility for us to be able to accommodate to that, for the industry to accommodate to that. Also, under Section 2, Subdivision 4, there are changes in the evidentiary standard in Section 2, Subdivision 3 to cite Argonne National Laboratory Carbon Intensity Formula Model, changing the need for renewable fuel producers and responsible parties to choose the PCA by a preponderance of evidence, of scientific evidence, that the default values are not appropriate. So this addressed the concerns around the responsibility to create and argue preponderance of evidence. The other language, Section 3 addresses concerns from the environmental advocacy community and adds a study to be completed by the Commissioner of PCA and the Department of Agriculture on indirect effects of fuel production. That's Section 3. That's a new section. Also, there were concerns about the complexity of a credit trading system being too burdensome for the PCA, and the language was removed for the credit trading system, Section 2, Subdivision 4. And Section 1 of Subdivision 8 addresses the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association's concerns that were expressed to us last week, and it exempts retail fuel distributors from being a responsible party. So those are the accommodations and changes that have been made in the original bill to meet the concerns and interests of the stakeholders.
So, Senator Sharon, what you're saying is that the first half of the goal is met by meeting the E20 mandate, and that is only goes into effect as long as we get the waiver from the federal government for that. And that the second half of the goal is met by further reductions, but that there are off-ramps that are in place that protect the business from extraordinary cost or unusual circumstances.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and if the technologies are not in place for them to be able to achieve that second 4 to 5%, if the technologies are not yet developed adequately for that to happen, there's an off-ramp that recognizes that if that happens, that they wouldn't be able to meet the standard.
Okay. Mr. Grant, did you want to add anything?
No, Madam Chair, unless there were questions about any of this.
Okay. I would like to ask somebody, and I'm not sure who needs to answer this, but I think I'd like somebody from Flint Hills who is an attorney who would be able to respond to the question that keeps getting raised about this, that people keep saying this bill will ultimately constrict or totally ban Canadian crude oil from tar sands. And I'm wondering if somebody can respond to that. Ms. Schmidt?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Schmidt. I'm with Koch Industries representing Flint Hills Resources. I also have John Knapp here as well. I don't think that I've said those exact words, but I think the reason that Flint Hills continues to believe that there are concerns, even with the Delete Everything Amendment about Canadian crude, relates back to Subdivision 8, Section 1. Subdivision 5. Full life cycle basis means all inputs and emissions related to the entire life cycle of the transportation fuel, including the production and extraction of feedstocks or other primary energy source. We believe that that language talking about the full life cycle basis, when you talk about Canadian crude, the explanation from that in use in California and also in my understanding in Washington, D.C., was that the full life cycle basis, that definition, which could be related back through the legislation, and John might be able to address this as well, could bring Canadian crude back in. Additionally, another portion of the bill that we think would also bring Canadian crude back into the forefront is the fact that several points in the legislation will allow Subdivision 3 carbon intensity values to be changed for gasoline and corn ethanol. And the author just talked about that. In Subdivision 1, upon the request of a responsible party, the commissioner shall, after notice, determine a different reduction schedule for a particular, et cetera. Basically, what that means is that in future legislatures, you can go ahead and change the carbon intensity values of those sections, which means that as early as next year, after your study is done, if you look back on page 4 of the amendment, 4.13, the commissioner can't make can't establish a different value until June 30th, 2010. But as early as June 30th of 2010, committee or this legislature could come back as early as then and change the carbon intensity values of any of these sections, which means that, and I think as was stated by Senator Dibble last year, you can't buy in future legislatures. So basically what this means is if you put this particular legislation into effect as early as next year, you can come in and change, or actually as early as June 30th of 2010, you can come back in and change any of these values. So as an investor, as a corporation that invests into the long-term future of our plant, there, if you go forward with a low-carbon fuel standard and you bring forward legislation like this, we should anticipate that at some point in the future, being that the national trend in California and in Congress has been to look at Canadian crude and its carbon footprint, we need to be careful and cautious that this legislature could come back and bring that back in based on those theories. So that's why we continue as a company to be concerned about that. And our principal concern, though, has been the fact that this section, Subdivision 5, continues to be in there. And I don't know if
Ms. Schmidt,
Mr. Knapp wants to continue with any.
If Congress decides, I don't think you have, I mean, you're not going to have any recourse then if the whole country is going in this direction. And in a way, we're preparing you. You'll be ahead of the curve here. But what I would like to do is have our legal staff respond to the issue of whether we can bind a future, I guess, whether we can bind a future legislature, or whether we can come back and change the value of that fuel.
Okay. Oh, Madam Chair, members, one legislature can't bind another legislature, and even in situations where private parties have entered into contracts, depending on the statute, they have been found to have been, they can be adversely affected. And I thought you wanted me to ask a different question. which has to do with the carbon intensity value. And just to make it clear, on page 3, line 5, and this may be for the author. Now, gasoline has a carbon intensity value of 1. And I assume gasoline, in fact, does not all have a carbon intensity value of 1 based on whatever factors go into calculating. If it's made from tar sands or if it's made from some sweet crude, probably looking at the whole life cycle has a different carbon intensity value. So assuming that's the case, and say Flint Hills makes an effort and blends more ethanol into their gasoline or whatever, at the time they're evaluated year by year, is it still the one that's used, or do they look at what that fuel actually is, you know, because it's not a one maybe. It's something more. So in other words, will they always get credit for activities that lower the carbon intensity value, even if it doesn't go below 1 using whatever inputs that are used to look at that particular blend of fuel? Maybe Mr. Grant is there.
Well, and Senator Sharon, it's the same question I asked you.
Yes. And Mr. Grant can throw me a lifeline here if I need one, so I'd be happy to hear from him. It is the goal of the legislation in achieving the 1% per year by blending fuels, by blending those fuels. That's how we achieve the 1% improvement per year over a 10-year period. So it doesn't change the default number. It is the blending is the way in which the 1% can be achieved in terms of meeting the low carbon fuel standard.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to Mr. Fuller's question. I
Mr.
think one
Knapp,
of the principal.
But Mr. Knapp, just identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is John Knapp. I'm an attorney representing Flint Hills Resources today. As Ms. Schmidt pointed out, one of the concerns is the very last sentence of the bill in Section 3, which seems to give the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency the authority to establish other carbon intensity values for the fuel. So gasoline could be one, could be 1.5, it could be 0.5. But the fundamental question, I think, that's highlighted by the exceptions and the off-ramps that Senator Sharon explained in going through the bill is that the number of contingencies that have to take place before this bill becomes effective. We may or we may not get an E-20 waiver. We just don't know if we will or we won't. This says if the E-20 waiver isn't granted, then the commissioner may, but doesn't have to, grant an exception to the bill. The other thing that we don't have is we don't have the technology to commercially make cellulosic ethanol at a commercially reasonable rate right now. And in order for this bill to really work, that technology for cellulosic ethanol is going to have to be effective. And the other contingencies, the cost to produce the transportation fuel, possible inadequate supplies of the low carbon intensity fuel. So what we're just suggesting is that there are so many contingencies in the bill that it's difficult for a business operating a $1 billion capital asset to actually plan for how they're going to operate that in the future.
Yes, just a minute. I'm going to ask Mr. Fuller to respond to this also.
Well, just a point of clarification, this is a fairly dense bill. So I understand when you cite to the last sentence on page 4, which limits the ability of the commissioner to establish an alternative value, refers back to subdivision 4. And subdivision 4 is not something that the commissioner can initiate. It's in response to a producer, a responsible party for its fuel, to come in and basically argue for a lesser value. I mean, they're not going to argue for a higher one. So they're, what they're saying is that they want to have more information. They want to have the commissioner be more informed before the commissioner responds to a request by a responsible party or a renewable fuel producer to argue that their particular fuel is better than the default value in subdivision 3. So it's not that the commissioner, I don't think, and it could be made clear, I don't think it's the intent that the commissioner is going to, on the commissioner's own volition, start changing these values. It's basically there as an attribute that a producer would want to have, a responsible party, say, look, it's wrong. Mine is much better than what you said. Probably the blenders more, or the non-petroleum producers. But that's the dynamics. That's the mechanism.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the concerns that we have is that when you start identifying indirect ideas as it relates to these studies, one of the things that we're concerned about is right now I think everyone has been talking about corn ethanol as the way in which we're going to be meeting at least half of this goal. Well, as we start looking at these different carbon intensity values, as we start studying them, if we are to find out that any of these change and it changes the equation, say, for example, if corn ethanol should change, transportation should change, it's going to change the entire formula for us to meet this. And so as we are going to be going as a result of this final Section 3, and there's going to be a study looking at the indirect effects, which is going to look at land use, I would assume, as it relates to corn ethanol. And should that study come back, as we've seen some studies across the country, and show that there is a different value to corn ethanol than we are seeing in this Argonne laboratory study right now, and let's say that is closer to 1 than it is to 0.7, that will change the entire formula for us to meet this standard, which will then, I would undoubtedly require the legislature to relook at this, which would once again require us to take a look at our capitalization of our asset. And I'm just saying that there are so many questions and concerns as it relates to this study. And by the way, the Argonne-GREET study, which I think is what this is based on, is at least 3 or more years old. There are much newer studies that are now being looked at that have come out since then. So what we're saying is that this legislation that is now before us is not even in taking into consideration some of the newest information that's out there. We think that there needs to be a lot more analysis of what's going on here before we start putting into effect something that is really being viewed as by our company and a variety of other companies as a huge concern as we look about our strategies for future investment at this time.
Okay. Senator Jungbar and then Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First thing I'd like to say is happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
To have to work on birthdays and not really enjoy your birthdays, but
this is fun, isn't it?
That's
this
the
is
way
where I'd
life
rather
goes.
Be.
All right. Where to start? Subdivision 5 is extremely troubling. They're right on. Full life cycle basis. I did bring copies out of the Star Tribune yesterday of the U study that says corn ethanol is no better than gas. The same point I made, if you want to hand out some of these, the last time we talked about this. It just is really troubling that as we look at things, I'll give you a few copies of another one too, because I think I have another report there on the optimal blend of ethanol, and quite honestly, I think legislation is going to go towards optimal blend before it goes to E20, because that's really where the research shows we do get the best bang for the buck and we actually do accomplish something in terms of carbon or carbon footprint. But if you think about Subdivision 5 and the full life cycle basis, including production and extract or other chemical conversion, since we already have a study from the University of Minnesota that says corn ethanol is no better than gas, it really negates the whole bill. You can't get 1 ounce of improvement by doing any blending under the current technology that's available in Minnesota. The next thing that's troubling is when we look at the testifiers here, and you're all great people, but if you think about who we have available in Minnesota, Jason Hill, research associate in the Department of Applied Economics that did that article, and really put a study and put this under scrutiny of corn ethanol and the life cycle costs. He's right here at the University of Minnesota. Why don't we have him come in here telling us whether this bill's good or bad? How about David Kittleson from the University of Minnesota in mechanical engineering that deals with particulate matter and biofuels? Or how about even David Tillman, who's done a great deal of research on biogas conversion and how that's going to work and what the future looks like? Because if we really are serious about a low-carbon fuel, we don't even have a start here. We're not even starting from square one. We have no science basis, and we do know that blending doesn't do anything. There's enough studies. We don't need a new study. Again, anybody that knows me well enough knows that I'm always out there looking for the studies so that I get mad when we do another study that comes out with the same dang thing that another study did. We waste the taxpayers' money and to no avail. But here we have three excellent people right here at the University of Minnesota. Not very far away. They should be the people here testifying. They should be the people telling us how we're going to get there on a low-carbon fuel and where the starting point is, and I guarantee you it's not in this bill. Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back quickly to, page 2, subdivision 2, in section 2, 2.23, and the exceptions, the off ramps and the soft landings, if you will. I was interested to hear this come forward as a compromise, as a recognition of some critique of the bill, and the author clearly actively listened and responded, and then the opponents took that as the opportunity to further criticize the bill. And so I just want folks to, it's a very fairly standard practice. It's happened to me a number of times where I've tried very hard to respond actively, to folks who have concerns and introduce some ideas that maybe address those issues and those concerns. And I don't disagree with my good friend that maybe some of these things aren't fully commercialized or fully available. But we need to decide, what the role of public policy is, particularly in this particular area of trying to reduce carbon from a variety of sectors. As we went through the debate in the power sector, as we went through the debate looking at our mercury emissions, there was technology that was coming online on the verge of being commercialized, and we tried to establish a fairly solid foundation in public policy so that folks could make a confident investment or move forward with the next step of their research and development to make some of those changes that are being called for in public policy, because it's an important larger public good that we're after. So that's just the statement I wanted to make, Madam Chair.
I would ask that we not be debating the bill, though, at this time. We still have a lot of testimony to accept, and so if you have some questions about this particular portion of the bill, then I would like to entertain your questions. But
Madam Chair, I think when someone says something that's still fresh, we, as committee members, probably need to respond.
Senator Dibble?
So, you know, I felt like you just told me that my comments were out of order, and I think we need to...
No, I wasn't saying that your comments were out of order, but I have a ton of hands up, and I actually think that even Senator Jungbar's comments might have been better after we have debated the bill, or when we come to the end of the testimony. So I just want, at this point, to be asking questions about this particular segment about the tar sand and its value. I think Senator Vanderveer was first.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and to one of the witnesses, I'm reading this, and it doesn't look like you need to go back to the legislature to change a value. It looks like the commissioner is empowered to do that. And so, I mean, I don't see where it says to go back to the legislature. It just says that the commissioner may decide. It says something about rule in here, but which I know is a process, but do I understand this changing this value could prevent the importation of the Canadian crude?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, obviously we would.
Ms. Schmidt,
there would probably be.
Was the question to Senator Sharon?
What was the question?
Oh, I'm sorry.
The question is the commissioner changing a value like in Subdivision 4? Could that result in the prevention of the importation of the Canadian crude?
Senator Sharon.
I think that if you read Subdivision 4, you'll see that the language that addressed this very concern that we heard from all of the parties about being cautious about letting the commissioner to make those changes, that you need to read lines 3.18 through 3.22, which says a party proposing a different intensity value is rebuttably presumed to have met its burden if it proposes an alternative carbon intensity value by applying. This is what we're directing the Pollution Control Agency to do. The greenhouse gases, regulated emissions, and energy use and transportation, or GREET, model developed by Argonne National Laboratory. It establishes a process by which, so it's not a decision by the Commissioner of the Pollution Control. It has to apply this national standard, this national process that has been accepted nationally as a way of determining the carbon intensity value.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon.
Senator Vanderveer, I'm going to have Mr. Fuller respond.
Madam Chair, Senator Vanderveer, the bill is complex. So, for example, you're right. The commissioner does not have to come back to the legislature except with a report. And then after whatever the legislature does, the commissioner can alter those values. If the commissioner established a value for a potential blend that was much higher than it was and it wouldn't allow for the reduction, that's one of the options to reduce your carbon intensity. Theoretically, it could drive a refinery to look for a different feedstock in order to meet that reduction along with perhaps some other variables. So, you know, you have the obligation of the refiner, let's say, to reduce its carbon intensity. One of the tactics would be to use an ethanol blend. If it's determined for whatever reason that those ethanol blends have a higher carbon intensity footprint than the gasoline itself, then that avenue of achieving the goal would be reduced, and you'd have to look elsewhere. And theoretically, one of the elsewhere places you would look, I suppose, is at your basic petroleum feedstock. You know, I mean, that's sort of a logical argument.
Madam Chair, if I could respond, too, to Senator Vanderveer's question. I think it helps, too, to look at the genesis for the bill. This bill is based on similar legislation in the state of California. They have a low-carbon fuel standard, and they do, in fact, have two different values, one for conventionally produced crude oil and another for Canadian crude oil. And that is one of the fundamental concerns that we have, is that this may end up with two different values, one for crude oil from the Middle East, for example, that's much easier to extract than is Canadian crude oil.
Well, I'll respect the chair's wish that we don't debate the bill, but I don't think this is a real good signal to send our Canadian friends.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, on the recommendation, are there changes? And obviously you have worked very hard on adapting and addressing some of the issues that we had during the last hearing. But your number four on the off-ramp, in the event that technologies and resources are not available, you say that's in Section 2, Subdivision 2? I guess I'm not finding that technology clarification. If technology is not there, can you please point that out?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, if you look on line 2.30, is not available due to inadequate supplies of lower carbon intensity transportation fuels. That's the off-ramp that I think you're referring to.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Grant, well, I guess it's still a little nebulous
okay.
to me as far as the technology and that low carbon intensity transportation fuels. There's still a disconnect there. And perhaps that's something that you can address and tighten that up a little bit better. Because I've read that several times and I still did not make that connection.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I would now like to start.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanchez.
And Mr. Grant or anybody, could I just, or Senator Sharon, on that particular line, and frankly even the line before it on 2.29, the commissioner makes those judgments. Is that the way I'm reading this? The commissioner determines whether or not 2.29 and 2.30 are achievable or not achievable?
Madam Grant. Chair and Senator Sanjim, yes, after notice and hearing, then the commissioner would make that determination.
Madam Chair, and just to follow
Senator
up,
Sanjim.
And particularly on 2.29, when we talk about will cause an excessive increase in fuel prices, excessive, I suspect, is in the eyes of the beholder, but it would seem that we're going to leave that in the eyes of now the commissioner with no guidance. Is that correct? Would the commissioner have any guidance in terms of what an excessive fuel price would be?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Sanjim, clearly at this point we don't have guidance in the bill language. That's something that's an issue we could certainly tighten up if you'd like and create a range if that's what's deemed most appropriate.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to dovetail off of that, is there a fiscal note required on this bill with the involvement of the commissioners?
Senator Rosen, there will be, but right now we are only debating the policy implications of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I do think the fiscal portion of this is very critical to the acceptance and the ability of this bill to continue on.
Right. However, the fiscal staff do not present fiscal notes until it hits the budget division.
Do we have a rough estimate, Madam Chair?
Mr. Grant?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, and I did speak briefly with David Thornton of the agency just before the hearing got started, they have done a fiscal note, but it wasn't prepared to this draft of the bill, and there have been several changes which we think will dramatically reduce the staffing and other burdens on the agency to comply with the obligations that the bill does create. So, they might be, you could call them up and ask them to speak to that, but that was my understanding.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
I do think that is a factor that we should, even though this is a policy, we should all keep in mind that there is a financial obligation to this bill outside of the obvious, but we need to remember that.
Okay, and I see Mr. Thornton is in the audience, but I'm not going to call on him now. I'm going to call on the testifiers first. some of whom were here in the past and were not able to testify, and I don't want to have to hold them over for another meeting again. So at this time, I'm going to call on Daryl Bungie and Rick Kadansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Daryl Bungie. I am here today representing the American Petroleum Institute, which is a national trade organization representing over 400 companies involved in all aspects of the oil industry. With me today is a representative of one of our members, Marathon Oil. Marathon owns and operates a refinery in St. Paul Park. The other refinery that services this area is located across from the chair's district in Superior. Murphy is also a member of the API. We're here today to testify in opposition to this bill. I've had to change my testimony a little bit due to the delete all amendment, which I have not had an opportunity to circulate to some of our experts, so I apologize if I don't have all the answers at this point in time. But one of the first things that struck me was in the previous version, I did not think that Canadian oil was a part of the bill. Now with the introduction of Subdivision 5 on page 1, I am concerned that Canadian oil is the target. The reason I say that is...
Mr. Bungie, that's part of the original bill.
With the exception that now, Madam Chair, that I think the off-ramps have loosened that up to cause more concern than it did before. The ability of the commissioner of PCA to change values, for example, is the biggest one, primarily because the original version with gasoline at a value of one was always going to be one. Now it can be something less than one. And the only way, one of the few ways I see that that value can be reduced or these 1% reductions achieved is through a change in the fuel stock. And the majority of the fuel that, crude oil that Minnesota uses and refines comes from Canada. Not all of this is tar sands oil. However, Canada does hold tar sands exceed the oil reserves in Saudi Arabia, so it's significant, and we value them as an ally. They are a non-OPEC supplier. I think you heard from Minister Council at the last hearing that one of their alternatives is to ship their product to China, which would upset some of our people who have spent and are in the process of spending billions of dollars as we speak to increase their pipelines across Minnesota to bring the tar sands in, not only to Minnesota, but to Wisconsin, Illinois, and other refiners that have made these necessary changes to be able to refine this crude oil. Madam Chair, we'd prefer that this be a solution at the federal level. The U.S. EPA is working on that as we speak. One of the concerns they've had and difficulties they've had is coming up with a study for the life cycle value. There are a number of these studies. I do not know if the Argon is one of those studies or not, but that has caused concern both in EPA's deliberations and California's deliberations. With that, Madam Chair, I'd stand for any questions. Or if you'd like Mr. Kadansky to go, we'll answer questions after.
Okay, let's hear from Mr. Kadansky, and then we'll ask questions.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Kadansky. I represent Marathon Petroleum Company. We wanted to just take a moment to give you a little bit of background on who we are and what we do here in the state of Minnesota. and register our opposition for the bill. Marathon is heavily invested in refining and transportation and the retail marketing of motor fuels in Minnesota and throughout the course of the Midwest and the Southeast. We operate an oil refinery in St. Paul Park, just south of the Twin Cities here. We also have pipeline interests throughout the state. Marathon has interests in the Minnesota pipeline. We supply over 150 independently owned and operated Marathon-branded stations throughout the state, and we operate 160 Super America stations as well. Overall, in Minnesota, we employ over 3,000 people. For the record, Marathon is proud of its investment and its commitment to renewable fuels. We have invested millions of dollars into upgrading our facilities in St. Paul Park, particularly our terminal infrastructure, and plan to continue to do so in upcoming years as Minnesota's use of renewable fuels, both ethanol and biodiesel, becomes more in play. Also, as an FYI, we have interests in two ethanol plants ourselves, one in Ohio and one in Indiana. And we also have an interest in Mascoma Corporation, which, as you know, is a leading research facility for cellulosic ethanol. Marathon opposes Senate File 13, and the risk of being brief and not to repeat some of the other comments that have already been made by others who have testified. Although we agree with several points raised by the concerned parties, our company has no technology available to allow our facility to meet the carbon intensity reduction set forth in the bill. And I know the amended version has sought to correct some of those faculties, but we wanted to kind of go on the record as saying that we can't meet it today. Nor do we foresee any technological means to do so in the near future. Even if the technology were available tomorrow, there's insufficient time between rule finalization and implementation to allow for the necessary infrastructure development that would be required, and we deem that to be critical. We also share the belief that Senate File 13 has the potential to unnecessarily complicate fuel distribution in the state and seriously threaten an effective response to supply disruptions should they occur. The legislation would undoubtedly, in our view, result in increased consumer costs in that the creation of unique boutique fuels specific to only to Minnesota will no doubt significantly reduce the economies of scale in our production model and therefore eventually surface at the pump. Our recommendation is for both Minnesota and the Midwest to delay adoption of any state or region-specific fuel standards until after Congress has set about defining a comprehensive climate change program for the nation, creating a patchwork regulatory environment across the Midwest, in our view, will only result in higher consumer costs and further economic difficulties and threatening of jobs. With that, I think we're both available for questions.
Questions or comments? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is to either of the testifiers today. Thank you for being here. I've heard a couple of times that thought is that because of the life cycle cost analysis here, that what we're looking at, that Canadian oil might be the target. However, it can also be viewed as the opportunity. I heard testimony the other day that said that they're looking at, with their extraction methods, they're finding ways to become even more efficient. And it's my understanding from this bill, the way I read it, is that this 1% per year marker could also apply to the extraction methods. So it's not just the refinery. So could we not view this as an opportunity as well?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think yes, simple answer to your question. But like so much of what's in this bill is when. We know the Canadians are looking at alternatives now. The primary source of fuel for their steam extraction is natural gas. They proposed building a nuclear power plant, which would significantly reduce their carbon footprint. However, what the likelihood of that is, we don't know, or if other technologies are available. Just as Mr. Kadansky has indicated, the refineries have already, in response to federal legislation, spent billions of dollars to make their refineries more efficient and cleaner. We've kind of expended all our opportunities that we're aware of today. We don't know what tomorrow brings. And I guess that's some of the uncertainty of this. What you're saying might hold true, but we don't know that yet.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gdansky, very interesting that a refinery is invested in the ethanol industry. May I ask you, did you ever look at expanding or developing ethanol in Minnesota and the reasons why you chose other locations?
Mr. Kadansky.
Simple answer to the question is no, we have not thus far looked into partnerships in Minnesota. The company that we're in partnership with is called the Andersons Group. They're based in southwestern Ohio, which is also where we're headquartered in. Okay. And the two facilities are kind of in that neck of the woods, so to speak. We're rather in our infancy compared to some of the other ethanol interests, and just simply not to the point where we're ready to expand more at this point.
Other questions or comments? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next speakers are Don Gertesmeyer and David Laborde. Welcome.
We're getting all set here.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Gertesmeyer, and I'm political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. And with me today is David Laborde, recording secretary of Teamsters Local 346 in beautiful Duluth, Minnesota. As is almost always the case when we come before a legislative committee, we're here today to talk to you about jobs. And you've heard a lot of testimony at the previous hearing and the beginning of this one about concerns on this end of the pipeline, about carbon, low carbon content and jobs. And I want to take you to the other end of the state and at the beginning of the pipeline, and Mr. Laborde will address that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Laborde, and I'm a business agent for Teamsters Local 346. Teamsters Local 346 employed over 400 hardworking men and women in the year 2008 within its jurisdiction. Within the pipeline industry, we construct new and maintain existing pipelines. The effects of the pipeline industry running in the state of Minnesota go way deeper than union membership. All these people that we employed received full coverage, family health insurance, and pension contribution. In the year 2008, the pipeline companies on the average employed over 500 people per job. This included the four crafts and their non-union support staff. Local 346 was involved in 8 jobs in the year 2008. The average payroll that the pipeline industry puts out per job was $1.4 million per week, with a cast company spending on the average of in excess of $700,000 in consumables. Consumables are defined as goods needed to build a pipeline, such as propane, fuel oil, lumber, gravel, ready mix, auto parts, tires, and etc. The majority of these goods are purchased within the local communities where the pipeline companies are working. Additionally, when these workers come into our local community, they need to find local housing, they buy groceries, gas, spend money in local restaurants, movie theaters, shopping malls, etc. within our local communities in the state of Minnesota. In closing, the state of Minnesota each year receives a tremendous amount of revenues, as do local communities, by allowing Canadian crude oil into the state. What I did in preparation for this hearing today is I contacted one of our local pipeline companies that performed work last year through the state of Wisconsin running from the Murphy Oil Refinery down to the Woodridge Oil Refinery in Illinois. I asked him these same questions that I just told you about here, and I would like to share this information with you. This was for U.S. Pipeline. They worked 12 months going through the state of Wisconsin. Their average payroll per week at peak manpower was $2.1 million. Their average expenditures on consumables per week was $1 million. And at peak manpower, they employed over 560 people, and this was for a job that went over 12 months in the state of Wisconsin. Our concerns are by adding additional restrictions in an already heavily regulated industry, we fear that our refineries will not build, expand, or maintain their current pipelines, and that they will go someplace else other than the state of Minnesota. Subsequently, our members our taxpayers will also follow them and go outside of the state to earn a living. Thank you very much for your time.
Senator Alcine.
Madam Chair, ironically, in 1978, when I was a young Teamster, Don Gertzmeyer was my business agent. And he was my business agent for 15 years in the Teamsters Union. And when he says that he fights for jobs, I believe him because I have a 30-year experience with him. If he has concerns that this is going to affect jobs, I have a lot of respect for what he has to say. I just wanted to make that as a statement.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me kind of conclude my remarks. And thank you. Thank you for that. You were always a good Teamster member. We've heard concerns about the Canadian crude and not importing it, and that would harm our friends, and then buying it in the Middle East. And I know you've considered this, and David's remarks are prior to the amendment. And our request to you is we know that we have to have clean air and clean water. We owe that to our children and grandchildren. That's an obligation that we can't ignore. So as you move through this, you know, and debate and try and come up with a piece of legislation that works, not only do you have to have great concern for the air and the water, but you have to protect these great jobs, especially in this economy. We cannot be harming these jobs that are there now. It can be done over the long term and maybe with more debate or whatever it takes. But please keep an eye out because there's a lot of good jobs on both ends of the pipeline that you have to keep in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Thank you. And I'd like to now call on Tony Quillis. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
My name is Tony Quillis, and I, along with Mike Robertson, represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on environmental issues before the legislature. I'd like to thank you for taking the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of the Chamber concerning Senate File 13. One of the benefits about being a little bit long down farther on the agenda is I get to take the red pen to my comments and get to be real brief because a number of them have already been addressed. So, and I know you're short on time. Minnesota Chamber has serious concerns about the low-carbon fuel standard set forth in Senate File 13. And these concerns are that we believe the legislation, as proposed, could adversely impact our state's economy by potentially increasing fuel prices and destabilizing our fuel supply, and therefore would likely fail to achieve its overall goal, which is to lower greenhouse gas emissions. Our main concern, though, is about the Minnesota economy and Minnesota jobs. Most businesses in the state rely on the transportation system to ship and receive products. The bill could potentially increase those costs at a time when our economy is in a deep recession. We've been saying for several years that the legislature should not make a decision on a cap and trade program until a thorough analysis of the economic impact of such a program. We take the same position on a low carbon fuel standard. What will the impact of this legislation be on the Minnesota economy? What are the environmental and land use impacts? Will jobs be lost or will jobs be created? In fact, it is my understanding that there is a University of Minnesota study now underway to answer these exact questions. We believe it would be ill-advised for the legislature to consider this proposal before the results and conclusions of this study are completed. And before I conclude my remarks, I'd like to thank Bill Grant and Senator Sharon for asking or including us in a number of conversations over the last couple of days, and I just wanted to thank the two of them publicly for reaching out to us. With that, Madam Chair, I conclude my comments and stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Thank you for your points. Stephen Rush.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you briefly this afternoon. My name is Steve Rush. I'm the Director of Corporate Compliance for Holiday Companies. We're a privately held Minnesota-based company, and we've been doing business in the state for over 8 years. We're a larger retailer of petroleum products in the state, and we sell other things, too, if people don't pay at the pump. and we employ approximately 3,200 individuals within the state. Holiday has serious reservations about Senate File 13, and we respectfully are in opposition. We have two principal concerns, and the first and foremost concern that we have is the potential adverse effects this legislation could have on our customers. Some of my testimony has been previously aired, and I won't go at great lengths, but we do believe there could be serious adverse effects on supply of petroleum in the state of Minnesota, as well as adverse effects on the price of gasoline. And it has been pointed out, given the fragile state of our economy, we need to be very careful about imperiling a stable and affordable supply of petroleum. The other concern that Holiday would have goes to the definition of responsible party and whether or not retailers are still included or excluded. And as I get towards the end, perhaps we could elaborate on that. It's been said by another individual that this type of legislation would turn Minnesota into a type of energy policy island, and I agree with that. I believe that supply shortages could result because we do have a special or a boutique blend, has been referred to, of fuel in the state. If there is a supply shortage for whatever reason, be it production, I've heard a lot of discussion about Canadian tar sands, and I'll stay away from that, but if there is any loss of supply, we could see fuel shortages, long lines in the pump, just like the Gulf states when they experience a hurricane, or California experiences with in-state refineries going down and being out of production. And then trying to find an out-of-state supplier can take quite a bit of time, several weeks, before you can start bringing in compliant fuel. And I know of no adequate pipeline supply from the southern regions of the United States to bring fuel here if there was a problem locally. Supply shortages can naturally lead to higher prices, and that's previously been testified to. And if there is an extended supply disruption, we could really see prices spike to a degree that perhaps we haven't already seen before. California has had some experience with this with their more specialized fuels within state. They, unlike us, have an indigenous supply of crude, and they have over 20 refineries, whereas we have only two. They can also bring in gasoline by water, so perhaps the state of Minnesota would be much more susceptible to shortages and higher fuel prices. Now, I do understand that the legislation does attempt to address the price issue by granting the commissioner the ability to issue some sort of waiver. I understand there was a question whether that is a rather vague and undefined concept, and I would agree with that. I'm a practicing attorney, and I've practiced administrative law in many different venues, including before PCA, and I know how long it can take for something like this to work through successfully. And markets move more quickly than litigation, so putting it in that type of venue is probably not appropriate. Going to my second concern about the definition of responsible party and whether retail is included, I understand in the pure concept of selling petroleum products that a retailer wouldn't be included, but retailers wear many hats. One example that I can think of involves the Duluth area. We have a number of very important units to Holiday in that area, and we like to bring supply over from Superior, from Murphy Oil, their terminal, and we would like to be able to understand that we can still do that. Obviously, the alternative of bringing petroleum or fuel from the Twin Cities area isn't as attractive because you're looking at a three-hour drive. Besides importing based upon using your own fleet, and I'm sorry if I wasn't clear there, we do operate our own tanker fleet. I'm wondering if a retailer also acts as a bulk holder of petroleum. So if you have your own storage facility, bring in a fuel supply and hold it there, and then later distribute it, are you therefore subject to this legislation? It's not clear from me that a retailer wearing those different kind of hats would be excluded. With that, it's my pleasure to address you here today, and I'm certainly here to answer any questions that any of you may have.
Questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sparks.
And maybe to Mr. Rush's point, I think he brings up a pretty good thing, and I appreciate Senator Sharon, your willingness to work with people. But again, as a senator that comes from an area that represents a border community, I'm noticed on page one we talked about a responsible party does not include a retailer, but I'm thinking of a lot of our retail shops that probably do import some gasoline from Iowa into Minnesota. And I don't know if Senator Sharon or maybe Mr. Fuller could help us to maybe answer Mr. Rush's question or my question for that fact.
Senator Sharon?
If the question you're asking me to answer is whether or not as a retailer that also is a bulk holder is exempt as a responsible party, the answer is yes.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Sanders.
Then how about as or an importer?
Senator Sharon.
By an importer, if you mean if a refinery is outside of the state of Minnesota, they would be a responsible party. In the sense that, let me say that in the same way that we address E10 and we'll address E20, those same rules apply to the boundaries of the state of Minnesota in this legislation as they do for the legislation that we passed for E10 and for E20. And so, just to further clarify that, we're already operating under those conditions under E10.
Okay.
Already in place.
Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanchez.
Thank you. And you got to help me through that once more. I'll just really dumb it down. If the gasoline comes from Wisconsin and it's not prepared as per this law, can it be sold in Minnesota?
Senator Sharon.
The law applies to the sale of the E10 and E20. That's the law, requires that. So in order to be able to sell the product, it has to meet the regulation. But the responsible party is not the retailer. Just like in an E10, right now, the retail distributor of gasoline has to meet an E10 obligation. But they are not a responsible party for E10. And that would be the same for these retailers who are here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanchez.
May I then further try to Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the Quick Trip station owner wouldn't be liable, but the company perhaps bringing the gasoline into Minnesota would be?
Senator Sharon, may I have Mr. Fuller respond?
I don't care.
Mr. Fuller.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Sanchez, I think that there is no prohibition on selling anything in this bill. I think what there is there's an obligation to reduce your carbon intensity standard. I think that's the case. And so I think if you didn't do that, then you're liable to some penalties. So you may choose not to do that. And in general, so that's what I think the bill says. I don't think there's anything in here that says you can't sell something. Is that correct? Or?
Senator Sharon?
That is correct, but that relates to the sale of E10.
Excuse me?
That's a different law.
So,
Mr. Fuller?
So then the question becomes, who is the responsible party? And by definition, that's only the petroleum. You're only looking at petroleum products. Any other fuel producer is not a responsible party. And so what was done was this was taken from the gasoline tax law, because it's hard to understand what the myriad of business operations are in the state at present, which goes to your concern. Retailers are clearly excluded on line 1, page 34. I think both you and Senator Sparks asked the question, if they are both a retailer and an importer, which some of them apparently are, what's the situation? I think that's unclear. That's my opinion. I think it's an opinion, because if you are an importer, you're covered, and if you're a retailer, you're not. Which governs? I think the intent was not to cover retailers. Okay, so maybe that can be addressed, but I think it's unclear.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have figures, or can anybody answer the question of how much is imported into the state? As far as what is refined outside of the state that comes in, and can anybody address that? And I do have another question after that, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Rush.
I couldn't tell you how much is actually imported overall by retail.
Well, Madam Chair, I think my question is also how much is refined that's brought into the state from other refineries. Do we know about that? I mean, who else is contributing?
Okay. Mr. Fuller thinks he has a partial answer.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I believe somebody privately has come forward and said that the convenience store gas stations, there's 3,500 in the state that get gasoline from a Sioux Falls, South Dakota refinery. So there's that. That's part of the universe.
But
and
then,
I believe it's trucked in.
But then almost all the gasoline in northeastern Minnesota anyways comes in from Murphy Oil in Wisconsin.
And so, Madam Chair, this law would apply to those same refineries. Is that correct? In Sioux Falls and Murphy, Wisconsin.
That's my understanding.
Okay. And Madam Chair, my other question is, we have mentioned penalties in here, and I am asking the author if she could tell me what is a penalty. Senator Sharon. My question was, you refer to the penalties if they cannot meet these requirements. What's your definition of a penalty? What is the penalty?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, on line 3.35 of the bill, it says that beginning in 2014, a responsible party may be penalized up to twice the least cost necessary for the responsible party to achieve the reduction standard net of other reductions already achieved. So, what that means is if the responsible party was supposed to have supplied X number of gallons and we know the cost of that, then the penalty is twice whatever that cost would have been for those number of gallons. Madam Chair, to further explain where we are with this, if you'll recall, we started with a credit trading program, and the penalty mechanism was tied to the credit trading program such that a responsible party would have to produce twice the number of credits they'd otherwise have had to produce in order to show compliance. That was a fairly straightforward way of establishing a penalty mechanism. When we decided, based on the concerns that we'd heard, to take out the credit trading program, we lost that convenient penalty mechanism. So I would say that this particular component of the bill is still a work in progress.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be interesting to explore what possibilities the amount that this is going to cost the refinery if they don't meet these requirements, what range of where the range is. I mean, right. This could be substantial.
And it would... Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I would think, though, that, again, that as we've testified, the fact that we think that suppliers or responsible parties are going to meet a sizable share of this obligation simply by virtue of meeting Minnesota's mandates for ethanol and biodiesel, that we're talking about a penalty net of those achievements that will already have occurred. So I think that the range is actually quite a bit smaller than what you're imagining it might be, but we could certainly look into that.
Further questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Mr. Rush.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much.
Next speaker is Harry Melander.
Yeah, really. No, now they're going to lie. My son, he's just in the sixth grade. He's just, I think he needs to take a shower.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Harry Melander. I'm employed by the St. Paul Building Trades Council as their executive secretary. Our organization represents over 11,000 construction workers, unionized construction workers, men and women from the East Metro area. And at any given time over the last 8 years, 10% of our membership and even greater have participated and work at Flint Hills Resource. I'm here today to just raise some comments that our council would like to bring forward in regards to workplace issues, and then respectfully just one or two of my own. As I like to say, and maybe aging myself, an individual that was not only was eligible to vote for Jimmy Carter, but did, and respectful of his energy policy, it always saddens me that we didn't continue on President Carter's mission. We would not be in the position that we are today. Our dependence on foreign oil has created great challenges, not only for our country, but on a personal level. For an individual who has had a son that's spent way too much time in Fallujah and Ramadi to keep that source of oil going. As a Marine infantry officer, any option that we have in regards to limiting ourselves on Middle East petroleum would benefit me and my family. Back to my employer. The relationship that we have at FHR is a very unique relationship. As I indicated earlier, at any one given time, and will continue this year, 1,100 to 1,200 construction workers will have the opportunity to work at Flint Hills Resource to have wages and benefits that will provide those types of opportunities and health care benefits that all of us in Minnesota need right now. FHR is a model employer. We have a very strong labor management committee, which is an example that continues to set high standards for everyone within the industry, and it also is a place where great innovation in regards to cultural changes within the construction industry happens on a daily basis. This is one of the few bright spots that we have within the construction industry in this very, very sullied economy. We believe that this bill, even as amended, will place limited abilities for our partners at FHR to continue to use Canadian crude. This will not only affect our local partners, but we were recently made aware that our neighbors to the north at Murphy Oil have delayed some expansions due to concerns in regards to environmental concerns that there also will affect close to 1,100 construction workers. These are tough times, and any consideration that you might be given to us in regards to the human factor would greatly be appreciated. Please consider these amendments to this bill. We are sensitive to the environment. As other individuals commented earlier today that we have a responsibility, but we also have a great responsibility for the human factor in these challenging times. So with that, I'll take any questions, Madam Chair, and if not, I appreciate the opportunity to come in front of you today.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. Are there any questions? Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Melander. This is the third time we've heard about job loss. What is it in the bill that makes you suspect that we're going to have job loss? I would think that our consumption of energy is going to increase rather than decrease.
Madam Chair, Senator, with the relationship that we have with our partner down at FHR, we, as you know, not being a scientist, but being within the construction industry and valuing their participation and the partnership that we've had, we and they have great concerns that this bill may create some challenges on the refinery and others that use Canadian crude because of the cradle to grave provision that it might affect not only FHR but other refineries around the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Senator Romo.
Mr. Melander, that's a very vague answer. Where are the job losses? Why will jobs be lost because there's going to be changes in the mix of our fuel?
Madam Chair, Senator, as indicated through testimony that was given prior to mine and also at our last hearing, some of the technology requirements that may be affected in this reduction could create that type of possibility. And we believe that any opportunities that that might be given in regards to limiting individuals the opportunity to work at these refineries brings great concern. As I indicated earlier, I'm not a chemist. These are findings that are based off of the conversations we had with our partner and feel pretty strong that it's accurate information.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I think it's important to just to keep in mind, Senator Rummel, that this is not a regulated industry. This is a private working business and industry. It's a private business. So they have every option whether to close shop or decide not to expand in the state of Minnesota, which equates to loss of jobs. So that's, I think, where the distinction is in this talk between the present and a couple years ago with our renewable energy standard.
Senator
Madam
Rosen.
Chair, Senator Rosen, I appreciate that. I did not hear in the testimony from the refineries, though, that they were considering pulling shop or going somewhere else. As a matter of fact, I thought what I heard them say is they will be making every effort to move in the direction of reducing carbon in their fuels.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, perhaps that's maybe it would be appropriate to bring Flint Hills up again or any other petroleum company that would like to or manufacture that.
Not at this time, but we will bring them up after we've heard from our testifiers.
I appreciate that, so we can get that straightened out.
Sure. Yes, Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, and Senator Rummel, Senator Rosen, and Senator Sharon, it seems like we have gotten caught into this discussion of Canadian crude constantly and whether or not it's going to be a disincentive to use Canadian crude. But what I did hear last time we got together was we said in this bill, crude is crude is crude is crude. And I guess what I'd like to have is you reaffirm that. And I understand that there's a lot of manipulations of the words here and there's a lot of problems I have with the bill yet, but I'm waiting for the sun to come up here in my thinking. From what I understand, crude is crude is crude. And if that is correct, then there is no difference between any source of crude, whether it's domestic, whether it's Far East, or whether it's in Canada. And that if there is no difference, then that takes the Canadian discussion completely off the table. Can you confirm that for me?
All
Senator
crude,
Sharon.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Chair Brettner Solon. All crude is given a value of default value of one. That's intentional because of where we are. And it is one of the reasons why, contrary to what you've heard here, it's very important for the state of Minnesota to engage and put its line in the ground about how to deal with the low carbon fuel policy rather than waiting or trying to be a victim to California's policy or an EPA policy. Where there is some anxiety, I think, that you're hearing, and then I just want to go back and further repeat what Senator Rummel is saying. First, and remind the committee that we already have passed legislation, E-20 legislation, And I want the trades to hear this and everybody to understand that this is already passed. We're waiting for an application and an approval at the federal level for E20, which meets, in terms of this standard, about half of its obligation. So the current economic situation that people are talking about in terms of its impact on jobs will not be impacted by this legislation. It will be impacted by other things outside of the state in terms of our economic recovery problem. But this bill, in terms of its impact on jobs, whatever that is not going to be any different than what under law that's already passed, E20 law. So that keeps getting lost here somehow, that I really need to have the members of this committee keep firmly planted in their mind. And then the other issue, though, has to do with how this fuel might be treated in the future and the demand or the necessity for Minnesota to continue to have this resource and the jobs that are associated with this resource. And Senator Rummel, you referred to this in terms of whether or not this committee or anybody believes that there's not going to be a need for this fuel in the state of Minnesota. That simply is not the case. But as that demand grows, what we're asking in this bill is a low-carbon fuel policy to help, as that demand grows, to blend more and more fuels with that are less carbon-intensive.
Senator Sharon, I think your bill states that gasoline has a value of one, but it doesn't have a value for crude oil. And also, I think the confusing part is Subdivision 5, the full life cycle basis. And I don't know if that's something that can be removed from the bill or if there's some way that you can explain.
I think that may be if people are tripping over that, we should look at maybe removing that language from the bill. And I'm certainly open as we move along in terms of listening to the concerns people have of doing that because it won't. I think that's certainly a possibility.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
And I guess just to follow up, and this is related to the answer, that it seems like we do have judge crude. So Canadian crude is the same as any other source of crude, which means that it's not there's not a disincentive for Canadian crude, and there cannot be a disincentive for Canadian crude unless there's some radical legislation that's passed in the future. So we are not looking at that here. We are actually looking at it. In fact, last week when we talked about this, we talked about the additional jobs from removal of benzene. We talked about additional jobs in the E10 addition of fuels. And I think there wasn't one that was not on that list was the removal of lead. All of those created new jobs. And what I'm seeing is if crude is crude is crude, then this will probably add new jobs, and it'll add more demand for ethanol. It'll add more jobs, especially in cellulosic ethanol.
Okay, Senator Carlson, I'm still going to ask people to leave their debate until the end of the meeting, until we've heard from all our testifiers. Okay. Senator Jungbauer, I think.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And you hit it. I don't know why people aren't getting it. It doesn't say anything about crude. It doesn't say anything about crude. That subdivision specifically talks about life cycle basis, and it talks about gasoline. So we need to understand what it says and quit arguing about what it isn't saying there. So that's why it is, I'd say 90% of the contention is around Subdivision 5.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next speaker is William Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. I'm Bill Lee. I manage the ethanol plant in Benson, Minnesota. It's a farmer-owned co-op, Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company. I've heard a little talk about refineries shutting down and loss of jobs. And from someone in the ethanol industry, I just want to say I feel your pain. But our plant is still running, and Randy Dole's plant is still running, and many of the all of Minnesota's farmer-owned plants are still operating, while the larger Wall Street plants have been challenged in this environment. We've been in operation 12 years, and we've been part of helping grow a corn ethanol industry in Minnesota to about 800 million gallons of capacity. The Minnesota plants, including many in our marketing group, are among the most innovative plants in the whole United States. I don't know if Randy will talk about his improvements in water usage, but he's done some remarkable work at his plant. Keith Gore down at Winnebago is replacing natural gas energy with biomass. He's taking wind energy to help run his ethanol process. Kerry Nixon up at Little Falls has a gasifier. He's trying to get that running again, but he and his company are partnered in a cellulosic biofuels venture with SunOpta, and they see the future of their co-op is moving into that part of the technology. And at Benson, we have the only operating biomass gasifier in the industry. So our plants here in Minnesota are doing some remarkable things moving forward. I was fortunate enough to be part of the MCAG process a couple of years ago, and I was there when the conversation turned to how do we reduce emissions from transportation fuel? Should Minnesota adopt a low-carbon fuel standard? It's a complicated question, and I would say that a lot of the way the ethanol industry feels about legislation like this depends heavily upon the way life cycle emissions are treated. And, you know, science is science, possibly, but science is often politicized, and I think it is the opinion of our industry that the science of indirect impacts and land use is highly politicized. At this point, because of that, I think it's because of the inclusion in of the indirect studies, I think it's difficult for our ethanol group to support this bill as it stands right now. I think that I'm going to make a few personal comments at this point. I think in general our group wants to be part of reducing the carbon intensity of Minnesota's fuels. And because of the E20 provisions that we may be moving to, that gives us a unique opportunity to be a significant contributor. I think we would all be the first to agree that we think Flint Hills should continue to access the lowest cost, most effective sources of crude that have the most national security benefits, and that would be the Canadian crudes. But I think when people say, how do we accomplish a 10% reduction in carbon intensity in fuel, I think it's commonly thought that the only approaches really are change the type of crude or let's build a cellulosic biofuels industry. I would submit for possibly future consideration the most effective for on many many counts is let's convert our existing corn ethanol industry into a more renewable energy driven industry. And I think coupled with E20, we can accomplish right there with nothing else, we can accomplish the goals, or almost all the goals here. So that concludes my testimony, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Rolstein.
Madam Chair, thank you. I would like to ask your opinion as somebody who's working in the ethanol industry. I can't get my arms around the chemistry of going beyond the E20, because I understand if the E20 standard goes into place, like you said, that's going to lower the carbon content of the fuel. But only 50% is what we're hearing. What I don't understand is how would we go the other 50%? I hear using a Minnesota ethanol because it is a cleaner fluid or fuel, but is that enough to go the other 50% over the time period? So,
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, Senator Olstein. This gets into the math of life cycle emissions. I think the default values contained in Senator Sharon's bill for corn ethanol indicated, I think, 0.75, 0.746 or something for corn ethanol. The bill as it stands now does not include a value for a plant that might be converted to biomass power. That could be a number around 0.5. So if you couple the improved performance per gallon with more gallons, that's where you can get to a significant part of the change.
Follow up, if I may. So then, thank you, Madam Chair. So then you're saying like cellulosic is 0.115 versus 1765 for corn ethanol. If you go to a wind generator running your plant or a biomass, so you're reducing your footprint. I see. I hadn't.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
It makes that particular product more valuable, depending on that, the encouragement of each plant making those kinds of changes and changing the value of their product.
But so, Mr. Lee, you're testifying against the bill, though, right?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lee, I was curious on the, if we move to E20 now, that's going to require more ethanol production, I'm assuming, to meet those needs. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I think it would require around 500 million gallons a year to do E20 here in the state. Maybe someone has a more exact number. We have over 800 million gallons of production capacity in the state now. So I think the answer to your question is no. We can. We don't need any more ethanol production to meet E20 at all.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dahl, half of those gallons are in my Senate district. Over 400 million. And Mr. Lee, he was actually started Corn Plus, which is in Winnebago, that utilizes the wind turbines. And then since then, you've moved on to Chippewa Valley. But the three ethanol plants that are using the low carbon intensity are relatively small ethanol plants, about 40 to 50 million gallons. So they've been able to do the gasification and the fluid bed technology and the wind turbines and anaerobic digestion. So they can be a little more creative. But when you get up to those higher levels of technology, and I'm asking you, Mr. Lee, is I would assume technology of that kind gets much more difficult. Perhaps it's not there. I mean, is it feasible to assume that these 100 million gallon ethanol plants will be able to utilize some of this technology down the road?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chairman, Senator Rosen, let me answer it this way. There's no reason that the difference between a 50 million gallon a year plant or a 100 million gallon a year plant as far as the applicability or robustness of these technologies. Having said that, some of these technologies like wind power are pretty well developed. Anaerobic digestion systems probably fairly well developed. Biomass gasification not quite as far along, but coming very quickly. I got to go back and call and see how they're doing at the plant, but we're working on it as far as we can. So there's a number of different ways you can do this, but there's no reason that the larger plants could not use this technology as well.
So, Mr. Lee, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that because of the full lifestyle basis of the ethanol, that it really isn't going to reduce the carbon intensity. And we can remove that section from the bill, and it may look like it is, but we're getting, in effect, no reduction in carbon intensity.
With all due respect, Madam Chairman, I disagree that that's
okay,
what I'm
well,
saying.
Okay, well, good. Correct me.
And I guess we don't have to look too much further than the recent report from the University of Minnesota. No, we think that it's intuitively obvious that the production of corn ethanol is lower carbon intensity than petroleum. And with the adoption of additional technologies, we're going to move that in a much more positive direction. What we dispute, though, is the imprecise and immature accounting systems for indirect land use that seem to be accompanying a number of studies, including the studies from Drs. Hill and Tillman. In some ways, if I may, I mean, it's a comparison. There's a number of flaws, but one is a comparison of a real operating system with something that really doesn't exist except on paper. And so that's unfair. to start with. So some of the assumptions that are made, I think, lead to some of the conclusions that you've heard, that more greenhouse gas emissions from corn ethanol than from gasoline. So
if we were to remove subdivision 5 relating to the full life cycle basis, would your testimony then support the bill?
I would be inclined to, and I would probably need to confer with other ethanol producers before I could speak on their behalf. But if there were, and let me put this in context. 20 years ago, we had about the same number of tillable acres in Minnesota that we have now. And in 20 years, we've increased yields enough to not only have record exports of corn out of the state, but also support this large production of corn ethanol. So we haven't, even in our own state, we have not had the perverse impacts predicted by indirect land use that are predicted in many of the studies. So I think that
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I did want to comment that the ethanol industry has responded rather rapidly to new technologies, and this would kind of play into this, but it's some of the troubling parts as well as our lag times, as research takes a few years beyond when you implement new projects and new technologies before it would catch up with that life cycle type of issue. So I think the industry has come far. It's constantly striving to do better, and that's just been one of my things in the bill, is it doesn't really kind of account for a quick way to do that within the absence of research. So we've got a – it's again, gets back to that subdivision 5 based on what we have for research today on life cycle.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Lee. Just one question would be, if this bill were to pass – wouldn't it make the ethanol that you are producing using more renewable inputs more valuable? It would put a premium on the ethanol that you sell in the marketplace. And I can't see how that would be anything but really good for business for you.
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I cannot disagree with your assessment. However, the unknown impact of, well, first of all, there is a moratorium on a plant such as Chippewa Valley ethanol from applying for an alternative credit, a better number than the default, until this study is complete. And considering the politicized nature of the science surrounding indirect land use, we have a low level of comfort in terms of how that process ends up. And then finally, I am speaking on behalf of not just my own plant.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I mean, I think it makes complete sense, and I would assume all the advocates for the bill, Senator Sharon, would agree with you that a plant like yours should ultimately be valued at a lower carbon intensity than a conventional, a typical corn ethanol plant. And so once, if we were able to make that adjustment, and the bill allows for that. I understand what you're saying about the study and that it's contingent on that, but it certainly in the end you will end up with a lower carbon intensity number than a conventional ethanol plant. No, but there's, I would think, well, I guess that's a question then, Senator Sharon. I mean, it seems to me that there's an ability to petition for a different value and that your type of plant would be, and I don't know if I'm reading the bill correctly, if that's how it would work, that you'd have to try to get a different value set for a plant that's actually reducing its carbon emissions already. That, to me, is something that we should encourage. I mean, that's the whole purpose of this type of law, is to encourage exactly the kind of leadership that you've shown with your plant and the other ones in the state that are trying to switch to more renewable sources of fuel to run their plants. I mean, that's what this is all about, and so I would assume that the bill would encourage that to happen, and maybe there needs to be, you know, you're not comfortable with exactly how it gets there, but I think that's the way I would read the bill, is how it's the direction it's heading.
Mr. Lee, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, thank you for the very kind words. Again, the current language does have a moratorium on applying for a new factor. In Minnesota, it would be not only do we have enough ethanol production already to meet E20, and not only we have done this on roughly the same acres we were farming 20 years ago, we can harvest enough ag residue and forestry waste without impacting land use at all. So in the case of Minnesota, what I think is appropriate is a direct impact analysis only and a deletion of all reference to indirect. Now, that may come in, the science of that is very complicated, and they may come in at the federal level later and be imposed upon the state that way, and that's okay. But I think if we kept it to direct impacts only right now, that would make this much more appealing.
Senator Sharon.
I just want to clarify a couple of things. This bill does not take effect until after 20. I think you're referring to the 2010. We're talking about the moratorium. You're talking about the moratorium for changing the default number. I'd like to clarify that that's not the correct. The Section 3, Subdivision 3, refers only to indirect impacts. On carbon, of fuel, of various fuels. And this particular piece of legislation doesn't even go into effect till after that. So that can be accommodated too. But I'd also like to talk to the issue that I think the testifier is saying is that the industry is concerned about anything that is relating to a discussion of indirect land use. And the reason that Section 3 was added is for that very reason, that as an author, I'm very concerned that that the indirect land use not be be targeted, or that particular kind of fuel source be targeted on indirect land use inappropriately, and that indirect impacts of all fuels need to be considered, which in the whole, then, will demonstrate that you cannot target one fuel for indirect implications without looking at all. Okay. So it was to really address that concern from the agricultural industry.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lee, you are speaking for the Minnesota Coalition for Ethanol and in opposition of the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I am accompanied by another member of the Minnesota Coalition, Randy Doyle, and I believe neither of us are in a position to say we can support the bill in its current form.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thanks.
And the last speaker at this time is Randy Doyle.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Randall Doyle. I operate the Claremont Ethanol Facility, Alcorn Clean Fuel, and I'm really here to speak in support of my industry. I have heard over the last year our industry take a lot of beating and bashing in the press and in publication, and I wanted to remind us kind of where we came from. Minnesota set up an industry that is head and shoulders above what we see in the rest of the United States. We did it right. It continues to operate, and it continues to be incredibly innovative. We have invested well in excess of $1 billion building this industry. We have created thousands of jobs. We continue to improve. I can speak very intimately about what we've seen in terms of improvement in my facility, but let me tell you that I speak from over 25 years of experience in the ethanol industry. And so I was here when, you know, I heard one testifier speak about, you know, wishing we had continued with President Carter's direction. And I really got started shortly after President Carter got things launched in the first place. But at our facility in Claremont, in the 12 years that we've been there, we have reduced our natural gas consumption by 25%. We've done that very carefully and over time, but that's been a huge plus. We've reduced our electric consumption by 20%. We have cut our water use more than in half. And we have every year improved our yield of ethanol per bushel of corn. At the same time, the farmers who own our facility, who deliver their corn there to process it, have done some very similar things in their farming technologies. I've watched them adopt technologies that I find almost Star Wars-like, where a tractor drives itself. That's incredible to me and would have been great fun when I was a child and driving a tractor and falling asleep. But still, they've adopted technologies that mean they use less fuel. They have adopted technologies that mean they plow less and go back and forth less. They've become much more efficient. They have adopted technologies that yield more per acre. And so at the same time, I've seen those improvements as well. And what continues to irk me, knowing what I know from our facility and from other facilities here in Minnesota, is that the assumptions that are made about our industry have our consumption of energies and inputs much higher than what we experience. They have farm yields and technologies much lower than what our farmers utilize. And so I'm really speaking to say, as you craft whatever legislation you craft, as you think about the path forward, consider that there are some incredible innovations that have happened already in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Lee spoke to the things that he's doing. But every plant is trying to do its job better, more efficiently. And I think we've yielded incredible results over the years. Our industry, I think, has shown this, been innovative, adaptive, and what I can state very proudly is we're locally owned. And that, I think, has been a huge plus in our model here in Minnesota. With that, I'll take questions.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lee spoke before you that, you know, like when we go to E20, if that happens, that Minnesota will, you know, have no problem producing that. But I guess my goal and probably a lot of my colleagues would be that the nation goes to E20 and we cut our demand for foreign oil tremendously. How about addressing that, ramping up to a national standard of E20? What do you think would have to happen for that?
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen. I am not certain how difficult it would be to get to E20, but we have in front of us a renewable fuel standard that almost mandates that's where we wind up. If you look at 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels by the year, 2025, that's about 20% of what we estimate consumption of fuel will be at that time. And so that's almost at that. That's the path I think we're going down. How we get there is a different matter, and clearly it will take the utilization of higher blends. It will take more utilization of E85. One of my favorite things to say is, you know, if we want to fix some of this use, let's just require that all cars are flex fuel, and then, you know, based on pricing, consumers can decide what they want to use, and if it's E85, that's great. If it's gasoline, that's great. Whatever works. That's the kind of flexibility that Brazil built into its system and seems to be working quite well for it. The path we go down in the United States may be something different.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your testimony to me, I was waiting for it to conclude because you are done, right? Everything I heard to me said why I would think you would be in support of this bill. And so I don't really understand your conclusion, because it seems to me that what this bill will do, you said the path that we're on, which I've always supported, is to get to higher percentages of renewable fuels, and which Minnesota has been such a leader in. I've supported that, voted for all the increased mandates, and this bill will do that. It will work hand in hand with that path. And it will also say that gradually we want that fuel to be better and better in terms of how it's the amount of carbon it emits. And you also testified, the rest of your testimony spoke to how you're doing that. And so it seems to me that this bill is really helpful to the renewable fuels industry. And I take you at your word that producers want to, make their fuel less carbon intensive, use more renewable sources to produce it, become more efficient. I mean, all those things are probably good for business and oftentimes save money. And I'm not understanding why you wouldn't want to go in this direction. It seems like it would be good for the ethanol industry in Minnesota.
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, my reticence and where I think where my fear factor comes in is how is that determined? My statements about the nature of our industry is to remind people that the assumptions that a lot of current ideas are based on are wrong. Going forward with the wrong assumptions can get us to the wrong place. And what I see here may not get us to the right place. That's my concern. It has to do with how we affect land use change, whether we're going to throw in who knows what. So I want to see that the path is clear. In its current state, I don't think that we could support it.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think the path looks pretty clear here. I'm confused about that. I think what Senator Anderson says makes some sense. But can you tell me, what is the subsidy currently for a gallon of ethanol?
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, there is no subsidy.
None?
None.
Thank you. No taxpayer subsidy of ethanol production.
Mr. Doyle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon. There is what's
he's in the wrong chair.
Ah, thank you.
Slowed you down a little bit. I'm sorry.
Good. Senator Vanderveer.
Yes.
Excuse me for misnaming you. There is an excise tax rollback on ethanol blended fuel that was put into place to help incent refiners, blenders to utilize ethanol so that you pay less tax on the gallon. That credit goes to the blender. It doesn't go to the ethanol producer. In the state of Minnesota, we still have some left on some of the early producers. They're still a part of the producer payment program that we set in place in the state of Minnesota. Currently, our facility does not receive payment. We're about $5 million plus dollars in arrears to what was owed, but that's where we're at.
So you're producing, what you can produce it and sell it without a subsidy.
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair. Senator Vanderveer. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Good job.
Good job.
Senator Jungbar.
Good job.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really kind of to Senator Anderson's issues and good points, but Mr. Doyle kind of hit it, and I alluded to it earlier that when science does studies, and Section 3 is actually starting to bother me more and more, too, as we look at alternative carbon intensity value, because Senator Sharon said earlier it would be on all fuels, and that would be another thing that would show a higher intensity value today, for example, on Canadian crude, because of the technology that is logged and the data available. So Mr. Doyle made a good point of it all depends on how it's determined, and today the science can't determine it except on the data that is available, which would already be last year's, the year before, something that comes in the past, not current with current technology. And then you get the wrong assumptions, so you come out with the wrong carbon intensity value, so we're never up to speed here. Whenever we're doing a study, science always has a lag. And that is my main concern, that we're not dealing with up-to-date data because it's just not available as we keep improving technology. We're doing good. Ethanol is doing good, but it's not reflected in anything that comes out currently. And this bill doesn't do anything to fix that. In fact, probably could hurt it.
Okay. Oh, Madam Chair. So
Senator
What's the
Anderson.
Alternative, though? Just throw up our hands and say we'll just let the status quo continue? I mean, that's not acceptable either. So give us a scientific solution, Senator Jungbauer.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson.
I'll allow you one more comment, and then we're going to get back on task here.
I think I started out with that, and I'm not sure if you were in the room, Senator Anderson. We have great people at the University of Minnesota. I mentioned three that I would love to see in our committee and helping us work on this because they've got a good baseline. They've got some good things that we could build on, and I'm frustrated personally that it's not here and we don't have these close by experts, top experts in the country, if not in the world, on biofuels and the economics of this industry. I think we need them at the table to know the baseline to start. And I think we're all on the same page of going there, but this is kind of a hopscotch way of trying to start.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and tell you what, I'm proud to have my ethanol plant here today, and Randy Doyle, he does a great job in Claremont, and I'm proud to represent him. But this is not my a side comment. As far as I'm concerned, if there's an expert in this state or country, that's one of them. I mean, he lives it and he does it, and he's made it work. But Mr. Doyle, my question though is. I mean, we've got a law here, at least a proposed law, that brings forth a lot of anxiety, obviously, by virtue of the testimony. And I thought I heard you say that, and maybe I didn't, so help me if I'm incorrect, that to some great extent, maybe markets and a desire that the public might otherwise just have for the virtues of ethanol and the environment and clean fuels might make this happen anyway, just through the market and the desire for and renewable, the RES. Did I hear that correctly, that perhaps, well, we could be going down this road anyway, just in a natural sort of way, in an unregulated sort of way from the standpoint of the law? And so, you know, why trap ourselves into something that might you didn't say this, I'm saying that. Why trap ourselves into something that might be onerous?
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, Senator Sinjum, thank you very much for the kind comments. I appreciate having you as my representative. I would say that my statement about market has to do with if we had all cars being flex fuel capable and we had blender pumps available where consumers could, based on their desire and price, choose the level of blend that we would see, at least it's the experience of those folks who have installed blender pumps, that they're selling a much higher blend of ethanol simply on pricing. And that's a market-based decision. If ethanol price, for whatever reason, was higher, then the gasoline blend would be higher that the consumer would choose. If ethanol price was lower, they would choose a higher blend of ethanol. It's the same kind of function that we've seen working at the stations in Brazil, where in the upper 90% of all vehicles sold there are now flex fuel capable, and every pump has either their what they call gasoline, which is 25% blend ethanol, or straight ethanol, and you see vehicles that are not flex fuel at all, like motorcycles, pull in and blend both because of the economics, and that's the choice that consumers can make. If I would like for them to make it in a vehicle that would allow them to drive either one, and not be kind of running on the ragged edge of whether or not it influenced their drivability. But I'm really talking about the impact of flex fuel vehicles in E85 in Minnesota. Thank you.
Senator Olsen, to this issue?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those lines, I think we all used to get that magazine ACE by the American Corn Ethanol. But in any case, there was some very interesting articles in there about cars could run. They were doing tests with E30 with a conventional engine without the flex fuel adapter. And they were showing no harmful results from that. So I guess my question would be then,
if we go to a nation as E20 and the positive impacts that that would be diluting the or reducing the carbon, would E30 be the next step then? Or I like what you're saying, though, about, you know, if they just manufactured every car flex fuel, that makes a lot of sense. But short of that, do you think that maybe E30 might be on the horizon? Or have you heard anything in that direction?
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, Senator Olstein. No, I've not heard about discussions of E30, with the exception of the allowance for blender pumps, where consumer could choose their blend at whatever they want. Blender pumps select at a minimum of E10, and then there's a button you can push for E20 or E30 or E40 or E85, and that's kind of the way those blender pumps work. And that's where I hear talk about higher level blends. But just in the RFS, as I testified earlier, it looks like we're heading that direction, the E20 direction already. Impact on vehicles. I know the study you're talking about from American Coalition for Ethanol, and they do show that current vehicles have the ability to utilize higher ethanol blends than our fixed 10% number would indicate. Auto manufacturers have to stand behind that, and that's a whole another debate.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, and I know you want to get this rolling, but this does the last two testifiers, but it's mostly directed towards Senator Jungbauer's comments and about the University of Minnesota. And I just want to say that the next time we need any information on ag issues, I think we should go to Iowa State or my alma mater, Colorado State University, because I just think this land-grant university that's supposed to be an ag-based school puts out stuff like this that does a tremendous amount of damage. It's a shame, and we send them money, and I'm just appalled. So I welcomed those gentlemen to this testifying table from the University of Minnesota.
Okay,
thank you. That's better.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Now, there is not time to get the other testimony that we wanted, and I feel like I've squelched all debate here, and we need the opportunity to be able to discuss the bill. One thing that we have neglected to do so far, though, is to adopt the delete all amendment, which is the author's amendment. So as a courtesy to the author, Senator Sharon, would you renew your motion, please?
Yeah, I would. May I ask you a few questions, please, Senator Prettner-Solin? I just need your guidance on this. We need to have this amendment moved, this delete all amendment. And then I wondered if it would be appropriate to have another amendment, which I don't have in the delete all, to remove subdivision 5, if we want to do that today.
I think it's more complex than that because it's referred to in other parts of the bill, too. So let's have that amendment.
I would move that we accept the delete all amendment A10.
Okay. Then on Senator Sharon's motion, any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. And Senator Sharon.
I would also, I know there will not be time for other testimony, but I really would like to have more time with this because in the future, because there are a number of things that I want to get back to. I think the university study and the issues around land use are of concern to the ethanol producers. They are a concern to me. They are the reason I've been very strong in indicating that you cannot target a particular fuel with these kind of criticisms without, you know, challenging that particular research and looking at other fuels. I heard people talking about the need for clarification on the costs off-ramp, you know, some guidelines around the cost off-ramp. The Senator Rosen was asking for further clarification about the penalty and what that means. We need to take a look at the language to be clear about that. I would like to be responsive to the request to get the full life cycle basis amendment removed. I want to make certain, as Mr. Fuller indicated, that the language in here is what is intended, which that the retailers are clearly exempt and not be held as responsible parties. So there are a number of messages that I've heard and needs for clarification that we'll be able to work on with some further meetings and amendments to the bill.
Okay, thank you. And then we will lay this bill over, but I would ask that Ms. Schmidt and Commissioner Thornton please provide us with some written comments. Commissioner Thornton on the cost basis or the cost impact of the bill, Ms. Schmidt on the job loss issue. Thank you. Any other discussion at this time?
Madam Chair, what are we doing with the bill?
We're laying it over. Any other discussion? Okay. Meeting adjourned.